So how are you tonight?
Great.
It's wonderful to have you on board, Jim. And last weekend when we had a little bit of a cold spell, I had you warming up my living room because I had you playing with your DVD there, and I watched it through and through just to be right on the ball tonight when you came on the show. So thank you for joining us, and I'm going to hand it over to you to bring through your presentation. I'm going to not leave your side. I'm going to be here every step of the way, but neither do I want to take any time from you.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I was really getting into your talk, so I'm scared. Because I like the way you present everything really clear and in an orderly manner so that it's understandable for people that, like me, that aren't, tuned into that.
Well, thank you. I'm going to have more time with you, I'm sure, at some point.
Okay. I'm sure Annabelle
will add on to the hour's presentation.
I'm sure Annabelle
I'm hoping you're coming. I don't know if you're coming to the Rocky Mountain Horse Expo.
I won't be there this year.
Be there. We will miss you dearly.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I'm sure my mare Annabelle has a few things to tell me. I don't know if I want to hear them or not, but I can start with the 7 things that all horses want you to know. So,
wonderful.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what your listeners know about the Masterson Method, but I'll just start from the beginning. It's a method of equine body work, where you learn to read and follow the horse's responses to your touch to help it relieve tension in key junctions of the body that most affect performance. So that's kind of the elevator speech for the Masterson Method. I initially began doing this because I was working grooming in the hunter-jumper show circuit, and it developed out of the need to release tension in the horse's body. And by being a good observer and naturally lazy and not wanting to do too much work, I was able to observe certain visual responses in the horse when I saw other therapists doing body work on the horse. And when I started messing around with it, I realized that by staying very light and not doing so much with the horse and watching the horse's responses, that the horse would start to release the tension on its own. So in a sense, you're communicating with the animal in a sense, but it's on a visual level, looking for really subtle responses that lead to larger responses and larger responses. So that's kind of how it developed. I started experimenting with it. Well, I can talk about a couple of things, that specific instances where a light went on for me, if you like. I was grooming hunter jumpers for a show barn that here in the Midwest that they used to show in the Midwest, and in Colorado at Estes Park was our Colorado show, and in Kentucky, and then eventually down to Florida, Ocala and Wellington. But we our trainer's vet used to bring in an old horse chiropractor from New Zealand who lived in California, who was pretty well known for getting very good results, and he used to fly out to the Midwest and the East Coast on a regular basis to adjust horses. And he'd learned from another old guy in New Zealand who'd been doing it for 40 years, and he'd been doing it for 40 years, so it was kind of a traditional thing. It was a very long lever, kind of forceful method of chiropractic, but one thing about this guy is he would closely watch the horse's responses as he worked on the horse, when he evaluated the horse, and after he adjusted the horse. And, for example, after he made an adjustment on the horse, he would step way back and give the horse some space and see what the horse did. And if he got a good adjustment, the horse would drop its head and it would kind of get a faraway look in its eyes, and it would shake its head and it would start to yawn repeatedly sometimes, maybe 5 or 6 or even more times. Sometimes the third eyelid would roll back. I don't know where that comes from, but they've got another eyelid that rolls back, and it was obviously pretty deep. Something deep had happened. So I was pretty intrigued by this. And then another thing occurred at Estes Park when we were at a horse show. The trainer hired these two ladies to massage the horses, and they started by going very lightly down the bladder meridian, which runs along the top line of the horse, to relax the horse before they started their massage session and to maybe kind of connect with the horse. And I noticed as they were doing this, they would go very slowly and lightly down the top line of the horse with their hand, and the horse every once in a while would blink, like a very definite blink, And there was a connection there between what they were doing and what the horse was doing, and that intrigued me. So I kind of experimented with that, and I ran my hand slowly down the horse's neck, and I would get a very definite blink. And so I would just stay there and do nothing, just rest my hand.
Can I just intervene there? Because I don't want to stop your flow, but how do we know the blink's not just a blink and it's a definite blink? Can you elaborate on that? Because I picked up on that in your DVD too, and I couldn't ask you then.
Yeah. Well, to me it was a very definite connection because it was pretty clear blink. So when I experimented with it, I would go slowly down the horse's top line with my finger, and if I got a blink at a certain spot, I would go back up a few inches, and then I would slowly go down over the same spot, and I'd get the exact same response at the same spot. So there was definitely a connection there between where my finger was or my hand was and where the blink was. So that's kind of a way to test it. And the other way to test it is to just wait there and do nothing with your hand, just very lightly, the level of pressure I call air gap, which is barely touching the horse's hair. And if you stay there, when you get that initial response and you wait, the horse will start to drop its head. If there's something there to release, the horse will start to drop its head, and it might blink some more, and then it might shake its head, and then it might start to yawn. Or it will lick and chew, or then eventually start to yawn repeatedly, similar to what the responses that this chiropractor was looking for when he got an adjustment, which is an adjustment, basically a release of tension that's pulling something out of alignment. So there was a connection there too. The chiropractor had gotten the same responses from the horse, that behavior that I was getting just by waiting and allowing the horse to let the tension go. So that's kind of how I got onto this, by watching that, by observing. Yogi Berra, the baseball player, he was known for pretty kind of funny sayings, but one of his sayings was, you can observe a lot just by watching. And so that kind of applies here. I wasn't trained to massage. I wasn't trained to do anything, but I was naturally lazy enough to just wait there with my hand and do nothing and get more responses from the horse. And I made the connection that these responses were making a change in the horse's body, because it's the same thing that this chiropractor had, the same signs that he had gotten. So I kind of ran with that and started messing with it and learned some basic anatomy and muscles from these two. I spent a few hours with these two massage therapists for the purpose of working on the horses in our barn. And eventually on the show circuit, I would start working on other horses and add new techniques and develop new techniques and combinations of different things that I might have seen being done by other massage therapists or craniosacral therapists or even chiropractors, but modify them to keep the horse relaxed during the process. Because I came to learn that if a horse has tension in a joint or a junction or an area of the body, and if you can move that joint or junction through a range of motion in a relaxed state, the horse will release the tension in that joint or junction. And you'll see the visual responses of the horse as he releases the tension, such as licking and chewing or snorting and sneezing or repeated yawning. And then when you go back to ask for movement in that area again, there will be a greater range of motion. So all of this kind of just came together that way. And I think the thing that the advantage that I had was, one, I wasn't trained to do anything else, so I wasn't trained when I found tension in the horse to do something that a book said or somebody taught me, but I just did what I observed, what the horse said to do by observing the horse's visual and palpable responses. And so that's one advantage I had, and the other is being not that ambitious and need to do something. I could just wait and let the horse do it. So it worked out pretty good for me and the horse in that sense. So does that answer that question, though, about
the blinking? Absolutely. And how would you explain it? I know you've said when the horse is relaxed and you're waiting and a release will be shown through the yawning, licking, et cetera, and their range of motion would have improved, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are you putting the improvement down to?
Well, this is my take on it, and again, it's just my take. It's kind of the world according to Jim, but
I like that world.
Yeah. well, it's the only one I know. So, but anyways, the horse, the way I look at it, the horse is a survival animal. They they're still guided by pretty strong survival instincts, and their first survival instinct is to flee, is to run away from any sign of danger or pain or discomfort or anything that threatens them. If they don't have the option of fleeing, then their second survival response is to brace against it or push against it. And there's always that discussion of whether a horse pushes against pressure and pain or runs away from pressure and pain. Well, if they have the option, they go the other way. And if they don't, they brace. And they'll brace physically and, you know, even pushing against you in some cases, or they'll brace internally. So when you put pressure on a horse and he doesn't have the option of going away from it, he pushes against it, he braces against it internally. If you soften that pressure, the horse lets go. And so that's one thing. You know, that's what I can make of it. When you put pressure on the horse, they don't have the option of fleeing, they brace. If you soften the pressure, they let go, and they'll let go physical tension that way. Another thing that I think probably happens if you're just resting your hand lightly on an area where the horse has told you there's something there, that it starts to send circulation to that area. You're bringing the horse's awareness to some tension he's been holding in a way that he can't brace against it. So his body will start to send circulation to that and release it. Another part of this, I think, is horses survive by body language. They don't have a huge audible vocabulary, to most of us anyways. So they maybe whinny here and nicker there, and that's pretty much it. But they survive in the herd and survive in the wild with body language, very subtle body language even. So if a horse starts to show signs of pain or discomfort and they start to limp along and complain about it, then they're going to be spotted by a predator or kicked out of the herd, you know, expelled from the herd if they show signs of weakness or pain. So they just hold it. They just block it out, and they just keep going. So horses will accumulate a lot of tension in the course of their life and their work that they're not going to show you is there because their survival depends on blocking it out. When you find it by looking for really subtle responses and using very, very light touch, and you find something there, if you, like I said, you bring their awareness to it in a way they can't brace against it, then their body will start to release it. So I think those are the two things, the communication of the horse, the body language and the subtle body language, and the horse's survival instinct bracing against pressure or pain or discomfort. That to me kind of explains how it might work. So that's the only, not being trained in anything or not, you know, being educated about horses' physiology, those are the two things in the horse's makeup that makes sense to me as far as the release goes, release of tension.
It's a good perspective, and it's kind of refreshing also to hear your perspective because it comes from experience, knowledge, and what you've observed.
Yeah, it comes from just a direct experience and observation. It's not something that I wasn't trained by somebody to do something. You know, when you find tension in a horse, then you massage it or you do whatever's the prescribed thing to do. It just came from doing something, observing the horse, and then seeing something else happen, and the result being a release of tension and an improved range of motion or other things that happen when you do some of the techniques that we use, such as this shoulder or scapular release. It's not a stretch. It's a technique where you ask the horse to, you pick up the horse's leg either forward or back, and you support it, and you wait till the horse relaxes it, and then you move it, let it go down through the range of motion in a relaxed state. That particular technique almost drugs the horse. A horse that has a lot of tension in the shoulder and withers, when he releases that, his head will drop. I think endorphins or dopamines or some kind of hormonal or chemical reaction just kind of puts the horse in this state where it's almost like they're drugged. And so something's obviously happening, you know, beyond even the visual responses that you're getting, the yawning and everything. So I don't know where I was going with that, what the last question was, but...
But you answered it well. You answered it well, so you're good.
Whatever the question was, I hope I answered it. So. But I'll keep going. I don't know, is the PowerPoint thing on your website? I can use that, or I can just go on without it, too.
No, I'd love for you to go with it. Vin, we currently have the slide up. How does it work? Can we get... I don't know if you're doing slide by slide or if the PowerPoint image goes at a certain speed.
Oh, mine, I'm just doing it manually. How does it work? Okay.
Vin should be able to do it for you because he put it in, right?
Okay,
you're not the one changing the slide?
No, I don't think I'm changing them. I'm just looking at them on my screen. I hope Vin's in charge.
He is. He's in charge of something.
Okay, where are we?
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
yes.
I can hear you. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yes, I am in charge. I have your slides up, Jim, and I've been sort of going along as best I could while you were speaking.
Okay.
So if anybody's having a problem not seeing Jim's slides, just refresh your browser, or you might have to close your browser and reopen it. But we are running it, and it's up and running, ready to go.
So on the slide number 3, how does it work? Well, there's a picture of Zoe doing it. That's how it works. She's in England. She's doing a technique of the head-up technique. But we'll go to the next one, number 4. Less is more. This is a description of the levels of pressure we use, because there's two things that the two components of this that you put together that makes it work. One is the learning how to read the responses of the horse, whatever the responses are, which we'll list next. And the second is the level of touch you use, because the level of touch determines whether you're staying under the horse's bracing response, which I call under the radar. And if you're pushing too hard on an area of the horse that's got discomfort, the horse will brace against it and go back to their, survival response of just holding it in. If you stay under that bracing response, the horse will start to let it go. So the levels of pressure that we use when I started, when I worked on, on the hunter-jumper circuit for quite a long time, and probably starting 2004 or 2005, I hooked up with a guy in Wellington, Florida, who was a vet tech for a very well-known vet there, who went off on his own to do his own type of body work, and he was immediately overwhelmed. I think he had hundreds of clients from his 20 years working with this vet, and he was swamped, and I was in Wellington trying to build my business up, my body work business, and so we partnered up. But eventually I would be working on horses, and people would start to say, well, that would explain what I was doing, because it wasn't very normal for body work, and they would say, well, how hard are you pushing? And rather than say, well, I'm pushing 2.4 pounds per square inch over a 3.6 square inch area for a certain period of time, I would say, well, about egg yolk, about the amount of pressure you would push to indent an egg yolk. And so the descriptions, as I started to teach this, that developed, coincidentally, most of them have to do with food, but the first one...
I did see that.
Yeah. The first one is air gap, which is what you do the bladder meridian. It's just barely touching the surface or the hair of the horse. And this air gap actually, it's kind of interesting. If you can go down, you can do this anywhere on the horse, not just on the bladder meridian, anywhere on the horse. If you go along very lightly air gap and you get a response, such as a blink, a light response, and you stay, the horse will start to release it. If you stay light enough and long enough, the horse will start to release. He has no choice, so it'll work. You just have to have patience. But if a horse can get used to barely touching the hair, you can back off a few inches and the horse will soften and start to release. And in some cases, you might go over the whole horse 6 inches or a foot away from the horse's skin, and the horse will release the tension because you're bringing his awareness to that area in a way that he can't brace against it. So air gap can be anything from barely touching the hair to I don't know, experiment. Maybe you can do it from across the barn. So that's air gap. Egg yolk would be the next level of pressure if you were to just gently push on an egg yolk. The next level is grape, what it would take to squeeze a grape without breaking it. The next level is what I call soft lemon. It's, if you were pushing on a soft lemon, and the hardest would be hard lime, which is in some cases as hard as you can push. Once the horse has softened and let you in some areas of the horse, like massaging behind the pole or certain muscles of the horse, you can actually massage as hard as you can. As long as the horse is staying relaxed, then it's working because you're staying under his bracing response. So that's what the levels of pressure are. And if we go to the next one, it's all in the response. I've kind of broken it down into different types of responses. There are, there it is. Mine's a little bit discombobulated, but yours I hope isn't. The subtlest responses we're looking for are blinking or twitching of the eye. So as I said, if you go very lightly down the top line of the horse and you get a blink, or the eye twitches or even in the eye widens or softens. That's a subtle response that the horse's body is telling you there's something there and they're not bracing against it. Then another subtle response would be twitching or quivering of the lips, sometimes the ears even. Another subtle response would be a change in breathing, sighing or letting out breath, dropping the head a little bit. And at the bottom it says softening of the eyes. So these are subtle responses that the horse tells you that what they mean is that there's something there you're bringing their attention to, but they're not bracing against it. Anna, you can stop me and ask questions at any time because I kind of get like a steamroller. If otherwise, I'll just keep going.
You know, one just came to mind because I worked with a chiropractor for many years. I'm not saying this is chiropractic. I worked with a chiropractor for many years at Flagadelt Farms. I was the groom that held the horses for them, and I saw some amazing change of behaviors and just amazing responses. Ultimately, 15 years later, I've taken the Reiki to the horses and do the energy healing, and I'm sort of seeing this comparison here when I see your slides, and I see some amazing aspects. My question is this. With the Reiki, it's all relaxation signs, very similar to what you're mentioning. With the chiropractic, it won't be relaxation signs. It could be that you also see horses acting out and then ultimately loving the chiropractor afterwards.
Yeah.
My question for you, other than relaxation signs and softening and releases, do you sometimes get the horses not wanting to participate or fearful of what might happen, fearful of the pain where your hands are? And if that is the case, how do they respond, and in turn, how do you respond?
Well, they do. It bothers the horse. I think it bothers their sense of survival when you're finding their stuff and they're not able to brace against it. So horses will start to fidget. And I don't know. I'm looking to see if fidgeting's on any of these. On the next one, is fidgeting? No. Fidgeting? Yeah, it's at the bottom of the next slide. I'll just go over the larger responses that indicate the horse's release tension, licking and chewing, repeated snorting and sneezing, especially in the neck area, shaking the head or the whole body. As things start to release, the horse will feel tingling and the blood starts to circulate into muscles that have been really tight and they'll shake. Repeated yawning is the largest, sometimes with that third eyelid rolling back, and stretching and flexing. They'll, as you release an area and step back to see what the horse has to say, often they'll reach around and stretch and flex. The last is fidgeting. Fidgeting means something's coming loose in the horse and it's bothering them. They're feeling some sensation that bothers them. So that kind of fear of what's about to happen shows up in fidgeting. And fidgeting can be anything from the horse turning to look at you to wanting to walk away from it to kind of stomping their foot if they feel some sensation. So fidgeting is a sign that something's loosening up. You know, I've just come to learn from observing and from seeing it happen over and over again. Horses that have a lot of tension and are fearful horses, it bothers them when you find this stuff. So they'll actually want to get away from it. So what you do is our response as a human is to back off a little bit, not to stop, because then you're conditioning the horse, you're showing him that you're going to stop if he acts it out. But you back off a little bit and you stay with it, and then the horse will release it, and then they'll go into these other responses like licking, chewing, yawning. And most of the time when you step back, because whenever we do anything on the horse, any techniques, we do a little work and we step way back as far as we can in the stall, the horse will do what he's going to do, whether it's any of these responses or turning away from me because it bothers him. And after he feels what's happened, they'll 8 or 9 out of 10 times, they'll come back over to you if you step out of their space. So the answer is, yeah, it does bother them when you find their stuff and they have pain, because they're conditioned to just, or they're programmed to hold it in and just deal with it. And when you find it, it bothers them. And when it's letting go, it bothers them. And they'll try to get away. But then, like I said, 8 or 9 out of 10 times, if you back far enough away out of their space, they'll come back over to you after they've gotten used to it. So.
And are you able, when you run your hands down these horses, are you able to determine whether or not it's physical, emotional, mental? Do you get some kind of sign with that, Jim?
Well, you know, you do Reiki, and a lot of people that have taken my seminars and courses do Reiki, and it's energy work, and it's all energy work. So there's energy going on. I just don't feel any kind of palpable. Some people will feel heat or vibration, and some people will feel other things. And so I don't feel those any kind of physical things like that. But what happens is, as by watching the horse's really subtle responses, is your intuition starts to kick in a little more.
Mm-hmm.
So you might feel something that you think the horse is feeling. As a matter of fact, if you don't, there's probably something wrong with you. But, you know, you don't. I don't doubt what I'm feeling or what other people's experience with the horse is. But you do get a sense of this relief from the horse, and all of a sudden this trust where they had distrust. And, for me, it doesn't get too much more specific than that, because I'm just kind of interested in releasing tension in the horse and making them more comfortable and move better. So, but I think you do find that your intuition starts to take in on, okay, what do I do next? You step back,
mm-hmm.
you don't think about it, you just go to a part of the horse, or you get some kind of, you know, your just intuition kicks in. So, does
mm-hmm.
that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and it kicks in just because from, I think when you slow way down and quiet your mind and you're looking for these real subtle responses, and then, you know, part of this method, you have to throw away the clock and not have an agenda or a time schedule. You have to kind of be on the horse's time, that it kind of shuts down a lot of stuff that gets in the way of our intuition. So it just is part of the process for the person doing the work on the horse. And I normally don't, you know, explain it in these terms, but because a lot of people, they're just interested in making their horse feel better and making their horse move better. But, you know, this conversation is a little bit more in line with the horse's end of it. So,
mm-hmm.
so anyway, was that a good answer?
Yeah, it does interest me because, on anything, I segregate a bit, but as a horsewoman, I might run my hand down and bring in the information that I've seen through visual, right, through the movement,
mm-hmm.
that I go,
yeah.
okay, in my experience, that's what's happened,
yeah.
or that's what I've seen before. If I run my hands over, can I feel it?
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's the big question of I'm not a vet, and I don't have decades of experience with that. It could be my intuition, could be mm-hmm. my experience, and that's what I wanted to hear from you, of which piece kicks in where, that even, like you say, you're guided to the next step,
mm-hmm.
but also that you can feel maybe that this is a long-term injury coming
oh, yeah.
through,
mm-hmm.
or this is a chronic condition coming through,
mm-hmm.
because, of course, that does come with experience.
Yeah, and part of that, when you're evaluating what's going on with a horse, they're, like, on a physical, from a physical standpoint, pain restriction usually is I make the distinction between pain and restriction, so... this helps you in your evaluation of what's going on. Pain is usually something that's current, that's happening right now in the horse's body, and restriction usually comes from something that's been that way for a long time. So, for example, if a horse has a poorly fitting saddle, his back's going to be sore. If that isn't remedied over a period of time, the back's going to start to become stiff and restricted and sore. Eventually, it's not going to have any soreness at all. It's just going to be dead, and it's going to be frozen. So that restriction would indicate a long-term or chronic issue. The pain would indicate something more, happening right now at the moment. So on a palpable level, you know, that's what we make the distinction between pain and restriction. It helps you determine what's going on, what's causing the issues in the body, which brings up a good point because we'll talk about it a little farther, everything that's going on in the horse's body that we work on as body workers or body work therapists or massage therapists is created by something. So often it's secondary to some of the primary issue. And the primary issues, some common ones are sore feet are a big one, create tension in the body and pain, poor saddle fit, bit or just dental issues. Conformation can create tension in the body, crooked feet and legs. Sore feet and legs create tension in the neck, in the pole, and in the neck, in the shoulder, in the withers, and in certain muscles that we palpate that point to what might be creating it. But anyways, my point is that we don't just want to clear up what's going on in the body. We want to find out what's creating it. So certain tension patterns in the body point to certain primary issues that might be creating them. And by making that distinction between pain and restriction, it helps you determine that. and as well as the, you know, the patterns, how they show up in the body, where, for example, sore feet will create soreness in the pole and the atlas on the same side as the foot. Often the lower neck on the opposite side will start to get sore from the compensation. There's a point under the pectorals and the girth point that will be reactive if the foot on that side is sore. So, and then something might be going on the diagonal behind in the gluteal and muscles and in the sacrum area. So those 1, 2, 3, 4 things point to the possibility of a sore foot in the front on that one side. So the point being that we want to determine what's creating the soreness in the body. So those kind of things help. I think that's just a long way off from chronic or current issues, but that pain and restriction is how I look at that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I used to try to figure out what's going on and what's creating the pain in the body.
Right.
Where should we go next? We're down to, we covered the responses.
Yes.
And now we went to...
my last slide is all in the response, larger responses.
Yeah, those are the big responses. When you do something, the horse starts to release tension. The first, you know, one is licking and chewing. That's a relaxation, kind of sign of relaxation. Snorting and sneezing. A lot of dressage riders, when they're warming up their horses, they'll go long and lower, warm them up in the arena, and they'll start to snort and sneeze, and that's a sign to them that the horse is starting to relax in the back, and they'll go to work. Well, that's a sign that the horse is releasing tension and relaxing. The big one, I think, well, the yawning is probably repeated yawning. Sometimes the horse will yawn a dozen times when they've gotten a huge release of tension. Stretching and flexing, as I said, you'll do a little work on the horse. Say you'll do a little work on the neck with some lateral cervical flexion, asking for movement in the vertebra as you go down the neck in a relaxed state. The horse, it has to be relaxed. It's not the amount of movement, it's the amount of relaxation that gets the results. But anyways, you'll do a little work on the neck. You'll step back. The horse will reach down and scratch its pastern with its nose. You'll go back and do a little more work. Go down farther down the neck into the shoulder, and you'll step back, and the horse will reach around and scratch its flank. You'll do a little more. You'll step back. The horse will reach around and scratch his hip. And you'll see this progression over and over. And you'll do a little more, and you'll step back, and the horse will reach around with his hind hoof and scratch behind the ear. You know, it's not just coincidence. The more you do, the more he loosens up, the more he actually stretches and flexes his own body, to kind of like when we wake up in the morning. All of a sudden it feels good, and they do it. So that stretching and flexing is actually a response. And all of these responses are just, they're changes in behavior that correlate to what you're doing. So whether it's a subtle response or a larger response or a medium response, they're just changes in behavior that have a correlation with what you're doing. That's all a response really is. So there are, you know, dozens more that you might notice while you're working on the horse. As you work on horses, that they'll happen over and over again, and you'll get the correlation between the behavior and what you're doing. So I think I already talked about the next slide in the wild. What makes this work is the horse's awareness and sensitivity to the outside stimuli. That's how they survive. They survive by being incredibly sensitive and aware of what's going on in their environment. So you can use that to get them to release tension. And I talked about fleeing and bracing. I talked about communication through body language, even the subtlest body language. I think it might have been Tom Dorrance said, the ride begins when you get out of the car and the horse sees you. I mean, they just pick up right away on your body language, and that's how they survive. So by paying really close attention to the subtle changes in body language in the horse, you can see what's going on with the horse. But at the same time, and this almost starts to happen naturally, as you practice more, you start to change your body language with the horse too. You don't walk up to the horse as fast as you used to do, and you pay more attention to the horse's eye as you're coming closer or doing anything, and the horse starts to recognize that you're moving in their language, and they start to trust you more. Instinctively won't show signs of weakness is the fourth point there. That's what I was talking about. And again, this is just the world according to Jim. If they show signs of weakness, then it threatens their survival. So that's why they block out pain. And the next frame, bypassing the horse's survival defense, starts with the bladder. Well, as, you know, on a practical level, it starts with the bladder meridian. When you go lightly over the bladder meridian, and allow the horse, read what's going on with the horse, and allow him to start releasing the tension, you're staying under the horse's radar, and you're bypassing that bracing response. So far, so good?
Absolutely. I'm intrigued by the piece about them hiding their pain. I've watched horses in the wild for 15 years now, and I adore it. And it changes every year because of the BLM and the way they've managed them and the fences and who they've taken off and so on. So you're constantly seeing different language and a change, right? And the horses in the wild generally make it to the 20s, versus horses in domestication can be in the 30s and the 40s. So the elements bring in a degree, plus the fighting, they do fight, plus the dynamics, all of this will bring in. And, yeah, as a whole, you see them fine. I've never heard anybody mention horses colicking out there. I know they don't make it to really, really old bones, or they're known in their 20s as old bones. So I do look at that to go, okay, how many of them have really got a pain threshold, high pain threshold then?
Mm-hmm.
And that's unbelievable, because you look at a thoroughbred and I don't believe their pain thresholds are high necessarily.
No,
so my brain then gets moving to go, okay, which breed, because some of it is breed specific, some of it isn't, would have a higher pain threshold and why, and where would that come from? So you've triggered me to at least look a little deeper with that.
Yeah,
and I absolutely hear you, because I watch my little Mustang, and Excalibur, I do believe, has a high pain threshold. His feet are a little bit sore. He's got a strange muscle thing on the side that nobody's been able to diagnose. It's gone like granite on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And the vets have still said, you can ride. I've brought in every practitioner I can think of to look at him. And I look at that and go, okay, there's pain there. I know that. I know it intuitively. Vets have said he's fine. But you do say, for this Mustang, he's not going to show it. He's going to muscle on through. And that's exactly what Excalibur does, versus another individual that would go, okay, look at my flank here. There's something going on. I can't even come near you today. So, yes, I'd love for you, I say love for you to look at that even more. Maybe it jumps out at you that you say this particular breed I found would be more stoic.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the personality of the horse, which is based, you know, a kind of a genetic makeup. Well, I look at it as kind of a genetic makeup in the herd. There's so many different personalities that make up a herd that contribute to the survival. But anyways, some horses are very, they'll just keep putting up with a sore foot or an abscess or whatever. They'll just keep going and going and going, and they'll get so tight and tense in the pole, and then eventually down the neck and into the shoulder and withers. And then they start to use the hind end to stay off the front end, and they never go lame. They just keep going and going and going. And I worked on a few horses where I released the tension and they were lame because they've been covering it up so long. And other horses immediately will start to complain. And they're the ones that get the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So, you know, they'll go off right away, and so they'll call the vet. And then, so it's there's a lot of just the, kind of the personality of the horse or the makeup, but a lot of it's in the breed, I think, too, because I worked on a lot of different breeds. And thoroughbreds, like you said, you know, they don't have a high threshold. Probably, and I always joke about this, fjords have no nervous system. They're just kind of like a block of concrete with four legs. And they're great horses, and everybody loves them. But every time I work on a fjord, they don't tell you a thing. And you have to be very patient and just trust that it's working and keep on going and with your body work until at some point they'll just let go. But the kind of the fjords and halflingers and stockier breeds, especially the smaller ones, can be pretty tolerant, you know.
Yeah, so, yeah. I hear you.
But you know, you pick that up so quickly when you're doing, even just doing the bladder meridian, you start to pick up that personality of that horse just by doing the bladder meridian. You start to, as you're watching their eye and you're going down, you realize, this guy, he's very friendly, and he likes people, and he'll do what you want, but he holds his cards close to his chest. So you can just, it's just by, you just pick up their personality by slowing down, paying attention to the horse, and letting go of everything else that you might know, you know, you might have learned from somebody. So you know, if you're a body worker, you know, you're not thinking of the muscles or the knots or whatever. You're just watching the horse and see what happens.
Are you going to explain a little bit about that, what you're talking about there, Jim, with this bladder meridian? Because I know you've got the slide up with where it is, but I'd love to hear some references towards personality identification with the bladder meridian.
Well, let me think. You'll start up at the pole very lightly, and you'll be going slowly down the neck, just, you know, below the mane, a couple inches off the top line, and you'll see the horse start to blink, and then he'll catch himself. And there's something there, but he is not going to tell you about it. And another horse, you'll get something, they'll blink, and they'll immediately drop their head and start to lick and chew and yawn. And that's a horse that has no trust issues with you. You know, they feel safe just letting it all out. So it's just kind of a first example. With that horse that starts to tell you something and won't, and just kind of keeps his eyes wide open, you just kind of keep going, and you keep going and ignore that. And then you'll get farther towards the hind end, past the withers and the hind end, and then their head will start to drop because you're getting a little farther away, you know, so their head will start to drop. And then they'll catch themselves and raise their head up again. And then you pick a spot that you feel like you got a pretty good hidden response in, and you just stay there, and you wait the horse out, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and the horse will start to fidget. He'll keep his mouth closed, and he'll want to start to walk around the stall and fidget, and you just walk with him and stay, and finally he'll go stick his head in the corner and drop it and maybe lick and chew, you know. And if you stay long enough, he'll start to yawn. So you can tell that's a horse that wants to keep it in and doesn't really, you know, he wants to take care of himself.
Mm-hmm.
So is that kind of...
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, it makes total sense. And I've seen some of that with the Reiki, that exactly that. You'll see their eyes shut, they sort of nod off, and then suddenly a head comes up and eyes are wide open. That they go, I simply cannot go to that place at that time, go to the place of relaxation, or go to the place where you can't be aware, whatever it might mean to them. Taking away the degree of the flight, i.e. optionally they're going there, but they hold back, just like you described.
Uh-huh. And one of my favorite stories is a horse I was working on at a horse show, and I'd taken his blanket off and thrown it over the stall door, and I was working on the horse doing, you know, I did the bladder meridian and then went into the other techniques, and I would step back to see what he had to say, and he absolutely wouldn't yawn, and I could see him, like, trying to not yawn, you know, like if you feel like you have to yawn and you're trying to hold your mouth closed, and he just wouldn't, refuse to yawn and let it out. So I just kept working because I knew it was working, and kept working, and finally at one point he went over, stuck his head under the blanket, and yawned about six times with his
under
head.
The blanket.
Because he didn't want to give in and let anybody see he was giving in. So maybe his job in the herd was to be the guard, you know.
Right, exactly.
You know? So, you know,
can't be seen to be weak, or how he perceived it as a weakness.
Yeah. Well, just like anybody, you know, you start to figure out a horse's personality, anybody does, as they're around them more. But, you know, when you really settle down and watch, and you're paying that close attention to the horse, not that you're concentrating at all, you're just watching, you know, you start to figure it out, you know, and it all makes sense, you know, what kind of horse you have there. And you can adjust the way you're working to that. So like I said, I just kept working on this guy because I knew it was working, and I could feel when something would let go and would move better, and so I knew it was working, so I wasn't relying on his feedback, and eventually he just let it out. So, whereas if I didn't know, you know, if I had taken him at his word, I would have thought, well, it's not working. Maybe I should try harder. And, you know, if you realize it's working and trust that it's working, then you don't try harder, then it works better. You're not pushing it. So.
Yeah.
And that's the next frame, search, response, stay and release. The one after that points to this, but we can go through this one. That bladder meridian is the process of making the connection between what the horse is telling you and what's there. You search by going down the bladder meridian. You get a response. You stay on that response, and you stay, and you wait, and you wait, and wait until there's a release. And that's the hard part, is the waiting, because some horses will release right away, and some will it'll take longer. But if you stay light enough and long enough on a spot, that the horse tells you something that is there, he'll have to release some of it. Whether he tells you or not, he has to release it. It's just not, he doesn't have a choice. But then if we go to the next frame, the importance of going slow, that's what I mean about you have to throw away the clock. You have to resist the temptation to push or to do something. And you get a lot of information just by doing that on, like you said, what type of horse you have. Another one of the principles is when you run into resistance, you soften. And then when you soften, the horse lets go of the resistance, and then you move through it. So that's part of releasing tension in a relaxed state. For example, one of the techniques is running your fingers down, going at each spot down the vertebra of the neck, and have it with your hand on the horse's nose and give a gentle wiggle and bring the horse's nose around as you come down the neck. Each step of the way, you wait for the horse to relax and wiggle the nose, so you're focusing the movement on that vertebra that your fingers are on. And when you run into tension or resistance or discomfort in the horse, when you get to a spot with your finger or a position with the head around at a certain point and the horse starts to brace, you soften both hands. You don't let go, you soften. And when you soften, the horse lets that tension go. And then when you move through it, there's movement. There's an improvement. There's an increased range of motion and improvement in the movement. And the horse usually will give you some sign that he's released the tension when that happens, such as licking and chewing or yawning. So I think the importance of going slow and just allowing the horse to do his part is the most valuable part of this. Any questions come to mind before I ramble on?
No, I think that's good. I visualize a lot when I hear people speak, so I'm kind of following along with your slide, hearing you, and then creating a visual in my mind's eye, and that all seems to go very smoothly.
Oh, okay. When the next frame, I think it says, is it primary or secondary? We were talking about that earlier. It's one thing to help release tension in the horse's body and make him feel and move better, but if you can find out what's creating that in the first place and help the owner or the rider deal with that, then theoretically the pain in the body won't come back. You know, of course, in reality, there's always something going on with the horse or a person. But some of the common causes of tension and pain in the body are foot and lower leg pain. Long before it turns into a lameness, it's creating some discomfort in the horse in most cases, and that's the horse is having to compensate for it in the body, and so it creates tension in the body in certain patterns. If you can, you start to, you know, recognize those patterns, and they'll start to point to what's causing it, then you can help the owner deal with what's causing it. Saddle and tack is a big one. And, of course, saddle is a sensitive issue, but, you know, some saddles don't fit. And some horses have sensitive backs, and maybe they have issues already in their back that are created by something. Maybe because of, you know, if they have something going on in the hind end, such as a hock or a stifle issue, and they're compensating for that, it shows up in certain areas of the back. And if you have a saddle that would normally fit that horse fairly well, maybe not perfectly, but then you have that soreness created by something else, then the saddle is going to aggravate it. Then the saddle fit becomes an even trickier issue for that particular horse. And everybody has their favorite saddle. And I remember, you know, I used to try a saddle and it felt great. And okay, I'll get it and put it on whatever horse. So, you know, people, you know, some people just don't realize that the saddle might be bothering the horse and feel great to you. So, and if you have a horse that's very stoic and tough, he's just going to put up with it until it really becomes a problem. Another story that I like to tell was saddle. I was working on a horse at a barn, and the trainer asked me to look at this other horse, the client of hers, or the daughter. The daughter was the client, but the mother had just bought a saddle for the horse, and she thought the trainer thought that the saddle wasn't fitting the horse properly, and the horse was in pain. And she asked me if I'd take a look, and I said I would, and I'm not a saddle-fitting expert, but I can take a look at where maybe I feel pressure points and then where, you know, I palpate in their soreness and put it together. And so we're all in the stall, the trainer and the mother and the daughter and me, and there were two old saddles and then a new saddle that she just spent a lot of money on. And I said, well, let's look at the old saddle first and see how that fits. So I put the saddle on, and usually the first thing I do is step back and see what the horse has to say, because if the saddle doesn't fit, the horse will be uncomfortable. His eyes will be wide. He won't relax his head. He won't show any signs of relaxation right off the bat. So I'll put the saddle on and step back and see what the horse has to say. Then I'll feel what I feel, maybe this, whether it's fitting or not properly, and whether it correlates to where the horse is sore. So the first saddle, I don't remember. I said, well, this one, the horse had a very sore back to start with. And I said, this one, it doesn't fit perfectly, and the horse is kind of sore, and he doesn't like the saddle. So let's see the next old one. And we put on the second one, and it fit better. And the horse also relaxed a little bit after it was on a little while. And then I said, let's see the new one. And I put the new one on and stepped back, and the horse was swishing his tail and pinning his ears. And he didn't ever relax while we were in the stall with that saddle on. And so I felt around in there, and I told her, well, I don't think this one's fitting the best. Of the three of them, this one is the worst. That's all I can tell you. And then as I took the saddle off and I was walking to the stall door, the horse lunged at the saddle and bit the saddle. And I looked at the lady, and she finally got it, you know, that saddle. The horse didn't like that saddle at all. So paying attention to the horse's responses helps in that. But with saddle fits, it's a tricky issue. I never tell somebody, oh, this saddle's terrible, it doesn't fit your horse, because immediately they bristle up and their defenses come up, and they say, I just paid $3,000 for that. It's a Beauté. It's the best saddle in the world. But if I approach it from a different angle and say, well, the horse's back is sore, and it could be the saddle, it could be a lot of other things, and I ask, how does your saddle fit? There's so many times this has happened, they'll kind of get quiet, and they'll say, well, I just bought this $3,000 Beauté, and I don't think it fits very well, you know? And whereas if I'd have said, the saddle doesn't fit, they immediately would bristle up. So the same, it works with people, too. You run into resistance, you soften, they soften, then you move forward. So the same thing works with people as with horses in those situations. Dental issues are big ones. You know, it's not just a matter of floating teeth. Horses can have more serious dental issues, and those will create pain in the TMJ in the jaw. That'll radiate into the pole and the atlas. And when the pole, I didn't talk about the three key junctions that most affect performance. The first one is the pole and the atlas. When tension accumulates up there, it affects the horse's whole body. The whole nervous system goes from the brain through the spinal cord through that junction, and it affects the whole body. Dental issues can create tension in the pole and atlas. And the other way around, if you have tension in the pole and atlas from something else, such as sore back or sore feet, it'll radiate into the TMJ. But there's always the possibility that dental issues are creating the pain in the pole, and head shyness, you know, that can come from dental issues as well as something directly in the pole. Riding style and conditioning. Some horses are way over conditioned. They don't get proper intervals of rest during their training session, and so the muscles don't have time to let go. Conformational issues, of course. Crooked feet, crooked legs. Horses that I worked on that came right out of the pasture that weren't even broken yet had a lot going on, and I would look at their feet and legs, and they'd have a high foot and a low foot or a crooked leg or something, and that'll create soreness and tension in the body. So that's the primary or secondary issues, what's creating the tension in the body. Next. Oh, the next one says questions and answers.
So on this primary and secondary, and you covered it really well, would there be anything else you'd want to add that people could look out for? So, for example, when you approach the horse and you explained it clearly with the saddle that you're going to read the horse's response, mm-hmm. Anything else that you can think of that you'd say, here's some top tips?
Well, not off the top of my head. Of course, the more you learn, the better. And if you start to pay attention to the horse's point of view, it really starts to make sense. It kind of makes exponential sense of what you learn from something when you get the horse's input. The value goes way up. And another thing is, I just don't think there's a one answer for everything. You know, it's never one thing with the horse. It can be, you know, one thing usually has to do with another thing, has to do with another thing. So be afraid to keep on looking. Don't, you know, just settle for, oh, it's his saddle, you know, his saddle, maybe his saddle doesn't fit well, but he may be sore in the back because something else is contributing to that, and the saddle's just making it worse. So I can't think of anything specifically. There is a really good book that I have on my desk by Sandy Bell called Before the Crop Comes Out, and it's just kind of common sense from the very beginning, ground up, what to look for, you know, what to be aware of in your horse, you know, starting with feet and going all the way up through saddle and tack and conditioning, and it's just common sense stuff. It's not really, it's not rocket science or anything super new, but when you lay it out in just that common sense format, then it does start to make sense, you know, that it's not too complicated. If you start from the basics, and it helps to be able to read what's going on with your horse and know what's going on with his body, and know what's going on with the horse, you know, the horse itself, in as far as what you are talking about tonight. So, communication with the horse, which is out of my field of expertise, but it all goes together, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, for you, Jim, in the past year, which horse have you worked with that particularly inspired you, and why?
Oh, the ones that probably inspired me the most were the ones with the sorest, you know, the ones that were working, most of them, you know, showing that had a lot going on. And you get, once you get them to start to release that, it's huge releases and huge satisfaction, and you see the horses just relax. So those are the things that inspire me the most, is seeing the release of tension in the horse and that kind of softening of the horse. That it's kind of out of the blue for them, you know. They're in the stall, they're showing, they're working, they're training 6 days a week. Their owners, a lot of times they're in a stall with trainers in the hunter jumper world. You know, the trainers pretty much call the shots and are in charge of the training and the showing. And so they might have an owner that shows up occasionally, but others have full-time owners. But it's, you know, sometimes you just get the sense for the horse, it's just out of the blue, wow, here I am in this regimen where I'm working 6 days a week and I'm showing, I know my owner loves me and I have a groom every day taking care of me and I get 3 baths a day and everything, but they're just sore, you know, and they're uncomfortable. And all of a sudden somebody comes along and it releases and they just drop their head, and it's a completely new experience for them. So that's those are the kind of things that make you want to keep going, doing
yeah.
the body work.
Who's the majority of your clientele, Jim, in the industry, if you looked at disciplines? Do you have somebody that you'd say that jumps out and somebody less or more reluctant to look at this area?
Well, I started out with hunter jumpers, you know, in the hunter jumper business. So I did that. Probably 95% of my work was on hunter jumpers for 6 or 7 years, and I probably worked on 600 or 700 horses a year during that period. And then in between, on the show circuit, in between shows, I would come back to Iowa or travel around and work on whatever was there. So the majority was hunter jumpers, and they're opening up quite a bit to the idea of therapies or modalities that make their horses more comfortable and move better. You know, they're looking for an improvement in performance. And dressage is opening up more and more to it. I worked with the U.S. Endurance team since 2006. Every 2 years I've gone with the team to the World Equestrian Games, the World Championships. And endurance riders are pretty do-it-yourselfers. You know, they're pretty hands-on people, but since I was there and it was free, you know, that I was able to work on their horses and they saw the benefit of
right.
it. What some of the, I think sports, I've worked on some standard bred, some harness racers, and it got good results, but they're not interested really that much, you know. They just, if they can't fix it themselves, then they don't want to fix it. But I guess as far as different disciplines go, I think the Western disciplines, the cutting, reining, and working cow horse and roping, the higher level sports like reining and cutting, or reining and cutting, they're starting to, get it, but it's hard to break into that. But I am getting more people taking my courses that are into barrel racing. And so they, like, in that situation, it's a measurable change. You know, the horses, it's a timed event. So if the horse goes faster, then so it worked, whatever you did. So there's the benefit of that, of working on a horse that's in a timed event. You can see if it's working or not. So.
Well, this leads nicely into my next question, because I know the majority of what we've talked about tonight would be how you've facilitated healing, and you're giving tips to the people over the phone and the internet as to what they can do for their own horses. But you've also created a program where people can attend the classes to learn the hands-on and have the hands-on experience. So what kind of individual do you draw there, and who would this apply to who's listening tonight?
Well, this is I started giving seminars in probably 2005 or 6, and working on horses. And last year, 2013, was the first year I didn't, you know, go work on horses on the show circuit. And so my business is entirely teaching and training people now. So the kind of people that come to the seminars, most of them are, most are women, probably 95% or 90% are women. I just did a course in Tucson. There were two men in the class of eight, and I was thrilled. So, and these guys were real horsemen, you know, and they were interested in helping and healing their horses. But women are the majority. A lot of them are older women that have been around horses for a long time, and they just want to do something new or different. You know, a lot of them don't ride anymore. They're getting up to like my age, and I don't ride that much anymore. I drive because it's more comfortable. But they want to do something, continue to do something with their horses and interact with their horses. And one thing about this method of body work, the Masterson method, I started doing it to improve performance, but it really does improve your communication and your relationship with your horse. If you go back to frame one, it says right there, opening doors to improved health and performance while enhancing communication. You know, just by following the horse's responses and releasing deep tension that they're releasing, and the tension's pretty deep they're releasing, it's not surface tension, it really does improve your communication or in your relationship with your horse. But a lot of people that are interested in that. And I still get people that are competitors or that compete with their horses, and their primary motivation is improved performance, because it does work. You know, it's about results. If it doesn't get results, people don't call you back if you're in business.
Absolutely.
So you can know every muscle in the body, and if the horse doesn't go better, then after you get your anatomy lesson, they're not going to call you back. So after they get your anatomy lesson. So there are people that come to improve performance, and then they discover this whole another aspect of the body work that kind of changes their perspective. And sometimes they get a little less competitive after they get into this, but... does that kind of give a picture of it's for anybody that wants to improve performance or make their horse more comfortable, but the bonus is that the communication and relationship with your horse, that's probably the biggest, for me, the biggest thing about this method of body work.
Yeah.
And we do seminars, and we do 5-day weekend seminars. We do 5-day advanced courses. I have a book, Beyond Horse Massage, and a video, and another video we just put out on dressage, kind of the biomechanics of dressage, to make people aware of how the horse's body has to work all together. It's not just one muscle doing one thing, but it's to make dressage riders aware of the body, of how the body does work together. And there are certain techniques in there for dressage horses. So it's all teaching now. I don't really, the only horses I work on anymore are in the course of teaching.
Yeah. Maybe that's what happens. We have to, you know, give some things up as we move forward. But you've got great practitioners out there that are representing you as well. And I just wanted people to hear that this isn't just for professionals. It's for amateurs through to professionals, for horse lovers, enthusiasts. And any time you put your hands on a horse, you're improving the communication. But you're giving a voice to the voiceless. So you're showing your horses that you care, and you're taking care of them to that deeper level and the next step. And I don't think you can go terribly wrong with it. From what I'm hearing tonight, it's non-invasive, doesn't require a license. So this is something that people can do and help their horses.
Yeah, anybody can learn how to do this. You don't have to know the anatomy. You just have to, I mean, to start, you learn it as you go along. I never studied the anatomy. I just learned as I went along, and then it stuck with me. But when you learn how to read what to look for in the horse, and you learn the levels of touch, and then you start learning the techniques. It's all about the feel, you know. And the horse will tell you where he's got tension and when he's released it. So it's very easy to learn. It's very rewarding.
We do have some questions come in.
Okay.
So let me go through these a little bit. Kim is calling in from Littleton, and she's referring to something a little while ago. She said, is there a reference for aiding people to identify the pain restriction patterns in horses that you recently discussed? As horses released, have you found horses will position you, being the practitioner, in a position where they know they need to release the tension?
Yeah, they'll turn their body towards you where they want you to work. You have to kind of make the determination, is he turning that way because he wants you to not go where he wants, where he's got discomfort and pain, or is he doing it because he wants you to go there? But they'll kind of physically position themselves. Not all horses will, you know. I normally rely more on, I'll step back and then see what the horse has to say, and then whatever pops into my head, then I'll go there and start to work on it. But a lot of people, the energy between the horse and the human is different for every horse and every human. So some horses, a lot of people will tell me that the horses often position themselves where they want to be worked on. And for me, I just get the sense they're more like waiting for me to decide where to go next. So as far as the patterns, it's kind of a multi-layered thing. There are certain, in the book Beyond Horse Massage, I talk about that a bit on what means where. But like I said, one thing, it's like you're gathering data on the horse as you're working on the horse and finding out where he's sore and where's restricted. You're just gathering data. It's not like A plus B always equals C. You know, you might think A plus B, oh, that equals C, and then you do a little more work and exploring, and you realize, oh, well, there's also D, E, and F here, and it's starting to point towards D. And so the more data you gather and information as you're working on the horse and from the horse's rider or from watching the horse go, the more it starts to make sense. So it's not like is an exact science as we would like, you know, for me anyways. And I don't know if you have a time, and I have another little interesting anecdote, but I was working on a horse at a show, and the horse show vet came over to that barn to evaluate a horse for lameness, and he was having a girl ride the horse and on different diagonals and go around. And since the horse was one of my clients, I stopped what I was doing, and I was standing over there behind the vet and his assistant watching. He was watching the horse go around, and at one point the vet turns around back to me and he says, what corner do you think it's on? And I'm thinking, oh boy, here's the horse show vet, I better be right, you know. And I'm thinking, What am I going to say? And he gets impatient. He says, you don't have to be right. You just have to have an opinion. He barks at me. And that's when I got it that, you know, vets, they have a lot of experience, so they know. I mean, that helps them, an immense amount. But they are just starting at a certain point. They just form an opinion, and they go from there. It's not like they expect to be right. You know, they want to start somewhere and treat that and then go on from there. So my point being that it's not always just, you don't really know. You just have to start somewhere and then start gathering more information, and it starts to lead to results or not. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah.
But the book, I mean, the Beyond Horse Massage book has the most detail. I have the DVD, which shows you how to do the techniques, and it's very visual and it's helpful. But the book has a lot more detail on what I'm talking about as far as primary issues and secondary issues and what to look for in the horse. So I hope that answers that one.
Absolutely. I love the DVD. It's of high quality, and I think people get a lot out of it. I've got Jennifer's question. It's rather long. She said, you were one of the first body workers to acknowledge the condition between the pole area and the stifle. Is that because the pole area is a great tension keeper area and is holding the tension for the pain that they experience in the stifle? Have you seen this in any other part of the body? Is that the release? I had a mare that had a severe spasm in her stifle when I applied Reiki to the pole area. She had a known stifle issue. She had a difficult time letting me back in that space again. I sensed her vulnerability.
The pole is the most important junction of the horse. The three, for me, that we start with are the pole, atlas area, the neck shoulder withers junction, where the neck and the limbs, front limbs join the body, and the sacral lumbar sacroiliac junction, where the hind limbs join the body, and then everything else in between. But the pole is probably the most important part, because anything going on in a horse's body shows up in the pole, as tension in the pole, and vice versa. If there's tension in the pole from anything, like I said, dental or sore feet or sore back or sore stifles, it affects the rest of the body. When the pole gets sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, I think the one that works for me the best is jammed up, it affects the entire body. So it doesn't surprise me at all that she was able to affect this horse's stifle by working on the pole in the atlas area. It's just everything shows up in the pole, and you can do that's one of the priorities when you're doing body work on the horse. Is the sooner you get the pole and the neck released, then the easier it's going to be to work on the rest of the horse. But what happens sometimes is they're so tight in the pole that you can't work directly on the pole, and you have to start somewhere else and then get to the pole. But the sooner you get the pole released, then the sooner the rest of the body releases tension.
Okie dokie. And another question from Renee in Nebraska. Girth issues when tightening. I've gotten a new girth. People tell me it's from her training years ago. Happens when first tightening. If I leave girth loose and go out to the arena and then tighten, not a problem.
Well, my experience with girth or cinchiness in horses is that there are the points at the girth right behind the elbow, the pectorals. The two pectorals, they go down between the forelegs. And where the girth goes over them, we call the hoof points. And if you palpate there with your finger and push as hard as it takes to get a reaction, sometimes you don't even have to touch it and the horse will pin its ears. Sometimes you push pretty hard, like lemon. Those two points we call hoof points, and they have to do often with soreness in the foot on the same side. So if a horse is girthy, often it's because of sore front feet. And one way but it could be because the horse in the past has been overgirthed or for some other reason, like you don't want to go up higher up the side when you're palpating there because there are other points up there that have to do with other things. But if you go along the girth underneath the horse where that pectoral muscle is and palpate, if she palpates on both sides and one side is more than the other, then it's possible that it's a foot issue on the more reactive side. It's possible it's both front feet. But if it's sore on both sides, reactive on both sides, then the possibilities are it's both feet or it's something else. But anyways, I always ask whenever I get that kind of girthiness or I get reactions there, I always ask them how the horse's feet are, because often there's something, they'll tell me that the horse has foot issues or navicular problems or had an abscess or is injected every 6 months, coffin joints, or something that goes along with the reaction in those points. So I don't know if this will help her or not, but the first thing that pops into my head when a horse is girthy is, are their feet sore? And also, if they're reactive up in the pole area, when you palpate up there or even put your hand up there and you get a reaction on the hoof point, those are two things that point to the possibility of sore feet. So.
Everybody's getting an awful lot of guidance tonight and ideas
as to
how they can help with their horsemanship. Diana's asking, where can we see video of you doing your work? I'm a visual person, would like to see a DVD or a YouTube. Well, the video you can get through Jim Masterson, and it's wonderful, the one, that's what we've talked about. Do you have YouTubes up and available? You do,
yeah.
I saw it the other day.
Yeah, we have a bunch. We have maybe 15 or 20 YouTube videos that are on our YouTube channel, Masterson Method.
Absolutely.
And,
so
you can
go there, Diana, and you'll see opportunities for both.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's it on the question front, unless anybody wants to raise their hand and come in live. I think we're pretty good and we're in a good place tonight.
Good.
I saw that you'd been over to the UK and you went to Richard Maxwell's. How did that go for you?
Oh, great. Yeah.
I couldn't get a dialogue going, and I don't think you do the Facebook thing all that much. But I did see it, that it was wonderful, and he's a great horseman.
Yeah.
So I was pleased to see he was aligning with you.
Yeah, he's great. He's a lot of fun, and he's so willing to share, you know, and
yeah.
Share what he knows and to learn. You know, it's you can never stop learning, and you know, a lot of people. I even have the tendency sometimes, I don't want to learn anymore. I want to stick with what I got.
But, right.
He's just always open to learning and sharing. So he's a great horseman, like you said. So.
Yeah, and it is that thing, you snooze, you lose, one, number one. But two, if you don't practice something, you lose it. And so at some point you say, I've got so much information, I've got better be using it, and don't want to get any more friends or any more information going. But I hear you. It is good to see and good to be open as to what's going on.
Yeah.
All right, Jim. Well, I want to thank you very, very much for coming and joining us tonight. It's been wonderful. How can people get a hold of you?
On the website is the best way. You can email us at Masterson Method, or go to the website, and there's a contact us page there, and a lot of information on the website. So I like to share as much as information as I can, because my theory is the more you share, the more people want to learn. So there's a lot of information on the website and on the YouTube channels, and you do that too. You share quite a bit. So
yes, we do. We spend a lot of time with the YouTubes and the webinars and the Facebook.
Yeah, well, it's great because people, you know, I think people, if they trust you when you're willing to share with them, it's not like, well, what are they trying to sell me, you know? Why don't they tell me what it is? Well, okay, here's what it is. And the more you share, the more people want to come back and want to learn more. So it works for you, and it works for me and a lot of people. Richard Maxwell.
Yes. Wonderful. Well, I do hope I get to see you. Obviously not in Colorado this year, but you never know.
Yeah, we're only doing one. We're doing the Minnesota Horse Expo this year. That's the only one we're doing, and then next year we'll hit them again.
Okay.
Yeah,
some of the horse expos,
they like to alternate every other year. So this year we decided to just focus on doing the seminars and courses, and we'll be out next year to all of the ones we did last year.
Okay, perfect. Well, we will welcome you back to Colorado next time around.
Have a great year
ahead. I'm excited. I will stay in touch through Facebook and any other means, and we look forward to seeing you in the future.
Yeah, and if I get out that way, I'll contact
you. Be sure to look us up. If I'm not here, Vin's here. We always have the open door policy, and you're always welcome.
Well, you're on the road a lot, aren't you?
I am. I hit the road in March, and we've got some new venues this year. We're opening up in Washington, Illinois, Georgia, new places this year, and I do go to Europe in the month of May, and it's kind of happened now. It's been a decade that the sort of the months get solidified, and then in June it's Bitterroot Ranch, and July it's New York and Connecticut, and it kind of continues. August is Cody, Wyoming. So I travel pretty much from March through to November with time at home as well. And then
I know what you mean.
Vin and Joseph come along, and it's a matter of some venues are very suitable and then others are a bit tricky. But, yes, lots of road work. And it's that thing, if you put your vision out there and your dream out there to help the horses, not all horses can come to you.
Mm-hmm.
But then you actually spread the word in another way by reaching out like you are, going to the places where they can't afford to come to us or they can't transport them to us.
Yeah. That's the way it goes.
Yeah. But it'd be wonderful to hear the updates from you and hear the stories. I love the anecdotes. I love the stories.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the time.
Okay. Well, you're welcome. I'm glad I was able to hook up.
Yes. We're being excited about it.
Okay.
So take care. My best to the family. And we look forward to seeing you next time.
Okay.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye. Good night.
Good night.